for any medical advice. We may discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. Lastly, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the host.
We'll be very disconnected from ourselves and hyper-vigilantly tuned in to the least trustworthy person in the room.
I'm just over here going, oh, is that why I was in so many toxic relationships?
It's a pretty slippery one. Yeah.
Hey guys, my name is Shalice Ansola, and this is Cults to Consciousness, where we discuss leaving high-demand religions and organizations and finding healing and independence through awareness and true individual sovereignty. As always, if you're listening only and you would prefer to see our faces, head on over to my YouTube channel at Cults to Consciousness. It would mean the world if you could like, subscribe, hit the bell so you don't miss anything, and thanks so much for being here. So, today's guest, I'm really excited about this one. He is a proud family man. He is a marriage and family therapist. And I'm looking at my notes here so I don't mess this up. He is an approved supervisor with the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy, as well as a level 2 clinical certified trauma professional. He has spent 20 years dedicating his life to helping people who are searching for happiness, health, and great quality of life while dealing with his own traumas. You may also know him as a TikTok therapist. He has over 1.2 million fans over there, and he has a plethora of amazing content that can help people like myself who have left high-demand religions, organizations, or relationships. So I am so happy to welcome to the show today Logan Cohen.
Thanks for having me, Shalice.
Yeah, of course. I saw your videos, and I thought, yes, I need to have this person on because you have some really great digestible content that I think anyone can understand. And now I want to go even deeper into that stuff so that we can help more people.
I'm looking forward to doing that with you. When I heard from you and you shared a little bit more about what you did, I was excited to do this specifically. I work with a lot of folks who are going through deconversion processes from fundamentalist religious groups. There was a short stint of time where I lived in the Pacific Northwest, but most of my life it's been in the Deep South. I've been around it and worked with a lot of folks coming on the other side.
That's amazing. And I want to get into your background as well, just so the listeners can have an idea of what they can look forward to. Today, we are going to be talking about how to spot an abusive relationship, which I think can translate over into high control groups, as you mentioned. How many people don't realize that they have been a part of an abusive relationship or control group until they have left, how to spot those signs. We're going to be talking about how to heal from CPTSD and talk about how we can relabel those trauma responses for the people who are going through those triggering events and for the people who can support those going through triggering events. So let's talk a little bit about your background. You had a wonderful, extensive story in your bio, but I wanted you to be the one to tell the audience about it.
Sure. It's one of those wounded healer stories. I grew up in a household with a lot of untreated mental illness with the adults and untreated addiction issues and a lot of the chaos and dysfunction that goes along with those dynamics. I was the oldest and internalized a lot of responsibility for a lot of the stuff that was happening. And in trying to cope with that, develop some addiction stuff in adolescence, as is pretty common. And in after I finished with my undergraduate degree at the University of Georgia in Athens, which is a huge party town, I was a raging alcoholic who was fascinated with psychology and anthropology and was a mess. I went to go, I knew I needed to get sober from alcohol use. And so I went to go work in a wilderness therapy setting with adjudicated youth. These were kids coming out of youth detention centers and psychiatric residential treatment facilities. And I had the background training that's required for this. It's a really high turnover type of job because it's very high stress and it's also in a really isolated space. I didn't really think that much about the high stress part. I was like 22 years old, but I was pretty focused on the fact that I would need to also live a very structured life myself while I was there. And I knew that I would have to get sober. So that's what I did. And after the first 2 or 3 months, I really fell in love with the work. And I was realizing how much healing power of not only the group and the healthy relationships in the group impacted the recovery of the young people going through that program, but I was also watching their younger siblings come through 2 or 3 years later, or seeing their family on visits and going like, oh my gosh, this is just a hot freaking mess. And knew I wanted to work with the families that they were coming from. So I worked in the woods for about 3 years. You know, the average shelf life of a counselor was something like 2 or 3 months.
I was going to say, that's a long time.
It's a long time. I loved it. It was also time to go. And I met my wife there, the woman who became my wife later. And we moved to Portland, Oregon, where I got my master's degree in family therapy with a focus in addiction studies at a school called Lewis and Clark College, which is a really neat graduate program. It's one of the very few liberatory psychology-based programs in the country. And that's why I went out there. I grew up in the Deep South in Atlanta, also in a Jewish household and in the Jewish community, and knew enough about a marginalized experience to know that as a white man, I was also missing a ton of stuff that I was not going to get in that region of the country. So went out there and got taken to school in some of the best ways. I was like the only cisgender white dude in the cohort that graduated. There were like 4 or 5 that started and they all dropped out. Some of those parts were very difficult, but again, really important learning experiences. And from there, came back down south, fell in love with the Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina, you know, working down there for a little bit, and looked at Charlotte, had the type of demographics, like the ratio that I am used to growing up in Atlanta. There's a large, you know, African-American population and, you know, pretty close to the border. So there's still, you know, a lot of Latinx and Latino influence that you know, appreciate and have always grown up around. So we moved down here and have been doing our thing since. I started practice in 2014 after being in community mental health for about 12 years. And the practice did well. Then in like 2017, I got news that at that time, my 6th childhood friend died from an overdose. And at that point, doubled down on figuring out what that was and why some of those things were happening. And decided that if, you know, my own buddies that I grew up with were going out like that and they weren't asking me for help, you know, how many other people were experiencing that? And the answer is an astronomical number. So I got more active on social media, you know, wrote a book about some of these themes specifically. And it's all about helping folks access some of these natural solutions to demystify our experiences and, help people have information to support them that's not tainted with institutional oppression.
Mm-hmm. Wow, what a backstory. That's very inspiring. And I think one of my favorite things about your videos is you just give relatable language to be able to describe people's experiences, as you mentioned, because I feel like until recently, even just talk therapy was demonized in a way or looked down on, or there was a stigma around it. And it's nice now that people like yourselves are coming out on social media and just blowing that open and just showing people, look, we all struggle from things. And this is how you can help yourself. This is how you can help others, which is so important. And just getting the word out there so people feel like they have a voice and that they're being heard without feeling like something is wrong with them.
Absolutely. That stigma is very alive and well in a lot of different places. And just because you know, that it is, you know, very much in American culture too. I think American culture is so embedded in religious extremism in ways that are not broadcasted to dominant culture. It's all very covert and woven into social and cultural expectations. And one of those is, you know, from extremism is if you don't have faith, what they call faith, which is blind trust, then you will, you can't be okay. You can't be fundamentally sane or healthy. So, you know, the idea was if you have a mental health thing going on, or if you have an addiction thing going on, and you cannot be saved by your faith, then you are fundamentally a yucky, sinning, cannot even have any hope type of person.
Mm-hmm.
What was the narrative for hundreds of years in this country?
Right. And I think it's still running rampant as we speak. And that's another reason why I wanted to start this channel, is it's not to attack religions by any means. It's just to show people that they may be in a group or a situation or with somebody who is controlling them in an unhealthy way. And I 100% am for believe whatever you feel is right for you, as long as you can be aware of you're making your own decisions and no one needs to be controlling you, and freedom to believe whatever you want, as long as you remain a sovereign being. That's my whole motto.
Absolutely.
And as long as you're not hurting anybody else.
So it's all about seeking truth. That's what it's supposed to be about. We'll talk more about that, I'm sure.
Yes. So let's get into the first thing then, how to actually spot if you're in an abusive relationship or in a group that is abusive.
So I am a huge fan of using this tool called a power and control wheel. You see me talking about this on social media from time to time. But by the time I'm done talking about these things, I want to see these things in every health class, just standard, like middle school kids. This describes all the different ways that people who have institutional leverage use manipulation and coercion to control the thoughts, feelings, and behavior of other people. Domestic violence, domestic abuse is not just physical violence. That's just the icing on the cake. That's just what draws the blood. There is a whole other set of control that happens. You know, just like if you have dogs that get into fights, or a dog with an aggression issue, you know, but the physical biting is a big problem, and that's what's going to, you know, draw blood and really, you know, create a dangerous situation. However, you also know that there's all this other nonverbal behavior that you have to pay attention to with your being. It's not just randomly, like this is not how animals work. Humans are no different, and in fact, way more dynamic. And actually, I've adapted a power and control wheel to religious institutions as well. I can I'll share that link with you after our chat today, so you can share that with folks.
Yeah, definitely.
So learning to use this assessment tool to see exactly what you're looking at in black or white.
Do you have that one with you, or even the one that you just held up?
Mm-hmm.
For those who aren't watching, head over to my YouTube channel so you can actually see it.
Totally.
Could you read off a few of those so that people know kind of what you're going with?
Yeah, and I actually do have a copy handy for the religious power and control wheel. So I'll just start going through these one category at a time. One is coercion or threats. Threats to be harmed by clergy or other community members. That's including exclusion or shunning. Withholding resources or basic needs. Reporting your behavior to clergy if you don't do what they want you to do. Blackmail. Forcing you to follow rules even if you're uncomfortable with them or they're illegal. Refusing access to your legal rights or, you know, basic integrity because you have to comply with these rules. Another is using children, making you feel guilty about the kids, using the children to relay messages with the rhetoric that is being used. threatening that you're going to lose your children or that your kids are going to distrust you because you're talking about doing things differently than what your congregation is, separating you from your children, illegally using pressure from the congregation to do this, tend to see a lot of privilege in male privilege, especially in some of the more fundamentalist groups, you know, especially in, again, in this country, there's a big patriarchal misogyny take on all of it. So a lot of times you see the power collected with either, you know, a small oligarchy of men or, you know, maybe one man specifically, but it, you know, like, find me one with a woman, find me one, and I'll take it back. Treating you like a servant, making all the big decisions, acting like the master of the house, the one that gets to define all the rules of each gender and the expectations. There's isolation, controlling what you do, who you see, who you talk to, even information that you have access to, restricting your access to information outside of your congregation, using fear or shame to dominate living spaces, to block other views, limited access to outside support, restricting access to your medical care, mental health included. Non-believers are considered evil to create this us and them mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Very common tactics.
That's a very long list. It's very thorough. Thank you for that. Was half. Oh my gosh. Well, thank you for sharing that. So what I'm hearing from all of that as a through line is really isolation. Isolation from self, from intuition, from critical thinking, from other people physically, and this creation of power from the higher ups over you. Does that seem like an accurate through line there?
It's a huge part of it. The humans, one of our greatest assets is our tribal and collective nature. So if you can be cut off from your ability to meet those needs and be connected to tribe anywhere else, you have to stay where you are. It's like feeling like you're on a life raft in the ocean in a tsunami. Like, you're not even going to consider anything outside of your raft.
Yeah, that makes sense. So in what way, it's hard because there's a very fine line between just being part of a group and getting a little bit culty with it. So what do you think a healthy group or a healthy relationship looks like that still has the community that people are searching for and how they end up in these cult-like situations because they just want that support?
It should be egalitarian. They should have much more leveled power differentials where there can be enough checks and balances that everybody's viewpoints are taken into the collective so that they can be a shining part of that tribe. This is in large part why so many people distrust institutions these days, is because institutions have become, you know, so far away from representing people and facilitating dynamic seeking of truth with all of the minds that you have at that table. This is what makes humans tick. That's what made us evolve. This is what brought us to the top of the food chain. When those things can't happen, we devolve. We cannot be healthy. We become very focused on a scarcity way of perceiving the world, and it all starts turning into the love of power, you know, trying to control outcomes or people or resources rather than allowing everybody's heart and mind to be a meaningful part of the process.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. So then for these people who find themselves, and we can use me as an example throughout if we want something tangible, but I was born and raised in the Mormon religion, and I thought everything was just peachy until I realized the damage being caused by being put down and being shamed and guilted and you are worthless and you need to repent. Until I really stood up for myself and said, no more, this isn't okay, and then decided to look into the doctrine, which was a scary slope.
It's a pretty slippery one.
It's a very slippery slope. I still didn't realize until years later how much it had affected me and my mentality and my behaviors, and how it was really easy for me to slide into other culty things. And it takes a long time to really unwind that. So from your perspective as a licensed therapist and someone who works with people with traumatic backgrounds, what can people do to first recognize that they've been part of something that is harmful? Mm-hmm. And then maybe the second part of this is we'll talk about how they can go about healing from it.
Sure. I think the ways that you recognize something has been harmful is either one, the pain becomes so obvious that you can't deny it anymore. Two, for some other reason, you choose to actively seek more critical truth, and your level of critical consciousness is developed to the degree where their small world thinking can't contain your mind anymore. Mm. But there are really kind of like only two ways to do it, and or they tend to be the two avenues from what I see. Because it is a very, very sticky web. It's very convincing, and there's a whole, you know, tribe of people doing these things that are normalizing all of it. So it can be super, super hard to see.
Right. I know it is possible, and you just mentioned different ways that you can wake up to it, but is it possible for someone else to kind of intervene on their behalf and have them actually accept the truth? And so I get this question all the time. This is where it's coming from, where people say, yeah, watching your videos, I totally understand that Mormonism is a cult and it makes perfect sense to me from the outside. But how do I help my son, or how do I help my cousin who's still involved and doesn't see the harms that it's causing? Is there something that people can do in a gentle, loving way to help them see the harms?
It's a good question. The yes. And first is, don't be super reactive and try to fight people or like win a debate. Don't do that. Mm. Environmentalists showed us 20 years ago that that doesn't work. And you know, we might dig ourselves out of it. We might not. But, and you know, like the PETA activists, it doesn't work. What you can do is, even the way that question was asked by someone and said, like, I can see it from the outside in, they can't see it from the inside out yet. Like they don't believe it fully themselves yet. It hasn't been, they're not to that level of acceptance internally where they can even confidently stand on that position. You know, especially relative to some of these other people. So the processes of integrating new information is a learn, do, teach, right? So like first you have to learn it conceptually. Second, you have to start doing it. So you see conceptually where all the things don't make sense, where the rubber hits the road, and you actually have to apply it so that you can start seeing it three-dimensionally. And it's not just some two-dimensional map, the information tree. And then third is you empower other people, you teach them about it, and you get questioned about it. And then their critical development challenges your understanding. So you have to figure it out on an even, you know, deeper level. But it sounds like, you know, the person wasn't, you know, quite to the level where they might, you know, be able to be as confidently stand there as they could in that position. But once we do have that level of integration, we can, you know, be available to folks, is not being reactive. Don't have a debate. Be able to regulate yourself. Nobody wants to listen to or engage with somebody that just is popping off the handle or making someone else uncomfortable. And, you know, maintain your relationship with them. Be very clear that your intention is first and foremost to maintain your relationship with them, and that you're just sharing information with them because you care about them and you want them to be happy, safe, and well. Whenever they don't want to hear about it anymore, you want to hear that they don't want to hear about it, because if you're not adequately pacing it, you're going to drive them away from you more.
I think that's a really great approach. And something that I had said to someone recently, and tell me if this is therapist approved, is I told them to come at them from a loving perspective. And instead of trying to challenge their beliefs, ask them about them. Say, tell me about this religion that you love so much, or tell me about these experiences that you're having. And I'd like to learn more about this and how it's changing your life for the better. And then maybe offer additional information of, oh, this is what I found. I'd like to get your opinion on it, and see if they can't come from a place of open understanding and curiosity rather than a full-on intervention.
Totally. And what you started to describe as well is just a Socratic questioning. Even Socrates realized that as he was training the, some of the next generations, the philosophical thinkers, that going toe-to-toe with defense mechanisms doesn't work. But if you ask people, how do you know that? Or where did you hear that? Or who said that? When was it? And helping people track how they know what they know, the likelihood of them figuring out where they're stumbling over something or assuming something that isn't verifiably or reliably true is a lot more likely. It'll come from them.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just hearing you explain it even further, it almost seems like it's a cheat way to turn on their critical thinking and get them to start processing things for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And also a cheap way of taking it less personally. Like if you don't have to explain or debate or have a counterpoint for everything, oh, where'd you hear that? How do you know that? Everything is, you're just kind of rolling with it.
Yeah. Okay, then. So let's go into what CPTSD is for those who aren't familiar, and how it relates to high control, high demand groups, and then how we can actively help ourselves or other people heal from it.
Sure. So complex trauma is a bit different, or they realize it's a bit different from a more standardized view of post-traumatic stress disorder. So the history of post-traumatic stress disorder is coming from war veterans. Before it was called PTSD, it was actually called shell shock from that specific history. So the understanding of trauma, again, until very recently, was coming from groups of people who've gone through one or two, maybe a handful of super high intensity traumatic experiences that were all environmental and very specific. So you're like, oh yeah, PTSD, that's when people have big startle responses to fireworks, right? Like when you, like those types of assumptions, that's where that comes from. What we've realized, as I was seeing working with kids in a community mental health 20 years ago, and was realizing the relational components were so much more helpful with, and they would get so much more spooked by, is now shown to be reinforced by research, especially with the Kaiser Permanente studies around adverse childhood experiences. If you are constantly having adverse childhood experiences, constantly having these little T traumas, and especially when those are combined with unhealthy attachment to our caretakers, which is, that tends to correlate with each other. The more chaotic environments are, the less likely the folks are going to have a chance to have those healthier attachments. Now that doesn't, not a black and white statement at all, just a correlation. What ends up happening is you have all of this attachment and developmental trauma that happens over time, where that presents very differently, where people are relationally quite cognitively and emotionally handicapped, and basically kind of look around for a dominant totalitarian leader to oppress them and for them to be the servant for.
Wow.
It's called a fawning response that happens. A lot is known about fight or flight and freeze. So And those are, you know, having a more stereotypical response is much more common with more standard PTSD. With complex trauma, when you have these constant relationships that are creating these dynamics of power and control and an inability to regulate yourself, what happens is everyone in that environment that's having to try to figure out how to navigate it and stay safe, they take a fawning response, which is a combination of the two, where you're kind of, you're dissociated from yourself. Parts of the freeze response are tend to get, you know, depressed and have learned helplessness set in pretty quickly, a lot of inappropriate guilt, and numbing from our own emotional experience, and then also borrowing some elements from the hyperarousal, from the fight or flight response, being hypervigilant about our environment, perceiving other people's emotional reactions as very threatening. And you know, that's what folks are going to have startle responses to or get spooked by, are, you know, people being upset with us. So like hypervigilantly attuned to the most upset, most bullyish person in the room and disconnected from self. And this becomes the script to get by during stress. You have a very low level of trust for our own judgment, and be very disconnected from ourselves and hypervigilantly tuned in to who a lot of times is like the least trustworthy person in the room.
I'm just over here going, oh, is that why I was in so many toxic relationships?
Super common.
After I left the church?
Yeah.
Yeah, I found myself in multiple just toxic relationships with people who had total control over me. And the thing was, I could even see it. I was like, this person is bad news, but I just could not get away from them. And yeah, everything that you were saying, I'm like, yeah, well, that makes sense. everything you're mentioning about almost being addicted to that, I don't want to say behavior, but addicted to being put down in a way, because that's what you know and that's what you're comfortable with. Is that
it
right?
Is. You become addicted to the behavior because the behavior produces hormones. And the behavior produces a very real felt experience that mimics what we're familiar with. And we unconsciously engage in this compulsion to repeat. It's the brain's way of trying to convince itself that it can work through it if it just gives itself one more opportunity to deal with the puzzle. It just doesn't have any other moves. So when it gets there, it makes the same move. It's like a skipping record.
Right, because it's comfortable. And also, do you find that in that case, if someone finally does find a partner who is calm and the opposite of totalitarian, that they tend to make drama to make their surroundings model what they're used to?
At first, yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely. That would be incredibly common. And I would say like that would be the smarter, the higher IQ that person has, the more they'll do that.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because like you got to know you're safe and you're smart enough to see someone becoming dysregulated a lot of times faster than they're going to even notice it. So why wouldn't you see if they can handle it? You know, like,
yeah,
it's a survival response, you know, and a lot of times that's where it starts to be really helpful to consider them more in this way, because it's a much more non-judgmental approach. You know, it's like, oh, I'm just extra. I'm all this stuff. Well, like, you know, if you got a foster dog that came from a dog fighting ring and you wanted to, you know, think it was a bad being because it was reactive on a leash, like, oh, the little thing thinks he's protecting you, or she thinks she's protecting you. Now, it's your responsibility to teach them that y'all are going to have a different vibe, but
right.
To just expect it to go, oh yeah, you know, like Jesus took the wheel, then you take it now, it'll be just fine. It's like that's not survivally sound. That's not very smart.
I agree. So people who are listening going, oh yep, that's me, I'm totally reactive, or I am replaying my childhood in this way that I could probably control but don't know how to. What are some tangible ways that they can actually go about changing their brain and changing their behavior to stop attracting these people, situations, groups?
So it's going to sound hokey, but it really is first learning to attune to yourself enough that you're not just chronically abandoning yourself. Because that really is the compulsion. And you're going to have a ton of different, very creative ways of doing that. So, you know, starting to create, doing some journaling probably every day, if you're at that point of your process, and writing about your experiences, paying attention to themes, places that you tend to get stuck and it doesn't go well, and you're going like, oh, I kind of like, I'm the common denominator, and there is something that feels really uncomfortable for me, like something's happening, and like knowing that those are there are incredibly important, and you're not going to know until you start slowing it down enough, because it's all really uncomfortable. Like, why, you know, who would want to know that? From there, it's, you know, working on your ability to regulate yourself, developing the verbal communication skills to, you know, not only, you know, talk yourself back down, but to start sharing what your emotional felt sense experiences are with other trusted loved ones. So you can start redeveloping relational trust and you know, different sets of communication skills for this. There's only so much work that you can do on your own in that space. I tend to say, you know, when you're healing from relational trauma, only 49% of the work can be alone.
Hmm.
At least 51% of the work is going to be in relation to other people, in relationship. Like that's when the good stuff really is going to get triggered. That's when it's going to be brought to the surface. And that can be a pretty scary thing to imagine early on in the process, because you can't imagine you being able to protect yourself through conflict or tension, or imagine well-meaning people to be in that tension with. But all I can say is that that's your destiny, and it's waiting on you. But I get it. It's scary.
It is scary. Especially when you find people who aren't familiar with someone who has been through a traumatic experience. And just as you mentioned earlier, someone saying, well, I'm just extra, when in reality they're being triggered in some way and their partner may not know how to handle that. So I'd love to get into those different labels, if you have maybe four or five labels that we can relabel in a more positive, helpful way for the person experiencing it and the person who is supporting the person experiencing it.
Sure. Gosh, I like what are some popular ones that you hear being used in a pejorative way or like a minimizing way?
One of the main ones I think for me personally is I'm too sensitive. Things hurt my feelings, I think, maybe more than other people. And in my opinion, yeah. I'm like, no, it's because you were being offensive. So that's like the main one. I'm engaged now, and my partner, bless him, is so patient. But at times I'm just like, you hurt my feelings. And he's like, really? He's like trying to figure out, what did I do? You know? So it would be great if you could give us some tips on maybe how I can learn to not be as sensitive in certain situations or take things too personally, and maybe ways that he can help support me in feeling those big feelings.
Yeah. So a lot of times I pick out phrases like that, like the too sensitive phrase, because if you're having feelings or reaction to something, then that's what's happening. And if the verbiage that you have to label it in your mind is too sensitive, then that's because it's what other people have called it. And no one has any business labeling or judging your range of emotional experiences. That's between you and the cosmos. Ain't nobody else. So generally where I recommend is starting with learning how to advocate for ourselves less reactively, so that we can have some ways of calling people speaking more directly, I want to say calling people out, speaking more directly to when people say stuff like that to us, they're like, you're being really sensitive. Like, sensitive about what? Like, do you actually know how I feel? No, I don't. Like, do you want to know? Well, I don't know if I even want to tell you. If you can't be clear that you want to know, then how would you even judge whether it's sensitive or not? Like, you have to be willing to learn how to lean into that tension and not rescue the other person's position or not minimize your own position.
Mm.
And that takes a lot of practice.
Yeah. Do you think that, because I think there's a lot of reactivity, especially in that moment where I feel like I'm being personally attacked when really he wasn't attacking me.
Mm-hmm.
How can someone such as myself, I have a friend who, how can someone detach that defense mechanism so that it's not so reactive as you mentioned?
Yeah. It takes a lot of practice and it takes it takes self-talk. It takes self-visualization. You have to develop some different processes for what you do in that space. This is something that I have an extraordinary amount of comfort with, but I'm also like a family therapist and I do that all day. I remember learning how to be much more comfortable initially in that space was working in the woods with adjudicated youth. And I remember one time there was a mentor in that space who introduced me in a really silly, playful way to self-visualization and self-talk. He didn't know that that's what he was doing. He was listening to this song in his earbud, the Uncle Effer song on South Park. If you're familiar with that one.
I don't know. How does it go?
Face, Uncle Effer, you're a big effing disgrace, Uncle Effer. I don't remember it now, but it's super silly and goofy. And he was listening to this, and he was like, Darren, dude, like, what are you smiling about? Like, what's so funny right now? Like, we're in the middle of a riot. He's like, Uncle Effer song, man. And like, so you're imagining something that's very anxiety provoking or someone's, you know, in your face, you can go to a different place. You can sing the Uncle Effer song in your head. You can look at a funny mole on their face and go, it takes practice and giving yourself permission to start practicing that.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm really good at that when the person isn't right in front of me because I'm also very introverted. And so, yeah, there have been times where people have pissed me off where I just sing the song. I don't know. I think it's just called F You or the F You song. It's like, F you very, very much. And it's like singing it around my whole house and really meaning it, you know, and laughing and smiling, even though I was hurting. But that is helpful. Okay. So I just need to practice having that same composure and levity when I'm faced with a real person who is upsetting me. Okay. Okay. I think another one, and this one really isn't one that I struggle with anymore, but not being able to trust people when you come out of high demand religion, especially one that you feel certainly betrayed by. It's really hard for people to hand over trust in a new relationship without that suspicion or feeling of you're about to be betrayed again. So what do you think could be a different label from a trauma response perspective?
Yeah, appropriately distrustful based on being burnt to a freaking crisp.
Mm.
Like how, you know, again, it would be very unwise to go giving away keys after stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people would give out fake keys and set up security surveillance cameras so they can watch to see how people react when they realize their key doesn't work. And you know, like that's not weird, but a lot of people would do that. Trust is earned. Trust is developed over time. And it's very tricky for someone in that position, you know, especially around trusting other people, because not only do you not trust other people, you also don't trust your ability to judge their behavior.
Yes.
Or your ability to follow through of those judgments of their behavior. So, parts of the interpersonal dynamic are a slow process of trust building that's much more adequately paced. It's slower paced from what you're probably familiar with previously. Give me your loyalty. Okay, here's everything. Now I own you. It's going to be much more drawn out than that. And you have much more consent to that than that. And then the other parts are learning to trust your ability to say no and set limits for the level of generosity with your time, energy, and resources. Because once you trust your own hand to a certain degree too, how much do you need to trust other people? How does that start changing? What that means in your mind? Once you can trust your own wings, the level of expectation that you have for being safe based on whether those branches are going to be there or not, you have a different relationship with it.
Yeah, and I think this also bleeds over into another one, which would be trusting your intuition and not becoming overly critical. So what I've noticed in people who leave high demand religions or groups is they overcorrect. So they go from just blind obedience to completely overcritical. And if that's not true, nothing else is true. And I can't trust any type of religion or person or whoever, which is almost detrimental to them because then they become so closed off to any information because they think, nope, everyone's out to get me and it's all a lie. What would you recommend for those people who are overcorrecting and aren't really broadening their horizons in an open-hearted way?
Go start finding meetup groups and probably also like a support group for folks who are deconverting from extremism. But if it's at that point, it's starting to turn into avoidance behavior.
Mm-hmm.
It's starting to turn into that hypoarousal, shutdown-y, depression-y type vibe. It's one thing to cocoon for a while and experiment and come back and be developing some things. But if you have no plan to do that and what you're focused on is just avoiding any interaction possible with other people, that's not how the human species evolved to exist.
Yeah. I love that. And there are so many support groups out there, even if it's just connecting with people on social media in those post-religious groups or just any type of group. Find a group of people who likes cats and connect with those people. I don't know.
Sure.
I think it's helpful to find people with your same interests and things that, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is just my take on things. I think it's helpful to find groups of people who enjoy your same hobbies where you don't necessarily have to even think or talk about the group that affected you. Or is that avoidance? Is that a bad idea?
No. If you're hanging out with people, it's not avoidance anymore.
Okay.
You should go on your own journey. Go do what you're passionate about. Go do what creates meaning for you. Go where you find flow. And you will meet birds of a feather to flock together with along the way that are doing the same exact thing, where you don't have to change anything about how you like doing that voodoo that you do. They're going to do the same voodoo and y'all can go have those same rhythms together.
That's awesome. All right. So I would love to do a Linda Listen moment, your sassy statement to someone that you want to stick it to, or some advice to the listeners, further advice, because this episode is full of advice.
Sure. Sure. It's going to be a bit of both because I like to be
okay,
the reverent and academic at the same time.
Okay, perfect.
Elders can be assholes too.
Okay.
Elders can be assholes too. So a lot of times, especially in the more conservative area or the more conservative of a religious group that you're familiar with, the more influence and power will be seated with the elders in that community. specifically with the elders, because all of the rules and laws are based on, I have seniority, I have leverage, so it's mine. Not based on nature rewards biodiversity, not based on how dynamic group problem solving skills, not based on your level of servant leadership and ability to empower, to help others seek light. Now, at the same time, we need elders. We need, like, oral tradition is incredibly important. If we didn't start having ways of encapsulating knowledge from our ancestors, oh man, humans, I mean, the Gaia might have been better off, but we wouldn't be doing what we're doing today, that's for sure. We need mentors. Mentors need apprentices as well. It's part of how they create meaning with some of the next phases of life that they're going into, and the apprentices need them functionally much more, existentially less at that point in time. But just because someone has been around longer doesn't mean you should blindly follow them. Make them earn your trust and insist that they can lose it as well.
So what I'm hearing is older does not necessarily mean wiser.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. I like that. I haven't really heard anyone put words to that, but I do think it's important for all the reasons that you mentioned. Do you have any final words of advice or resources for people who are escaping or leaving these high demand religions, relationships, and groups who may need a little extra help in regulating their stress and trauma responses?
Sure, sure, sure. I've got some social media accounts that you can check out that talk about a lot of these kind of mindsets and processes of healing from these types of relational wounds a lot. Have a new short form content that I tend to drop every day. If you go to my website at logancohen.com, there's also, you can see a daily motivation and support subscription-based service that I have, where there's exclusive content sent out to subscribers, sent right to your phone, and 4 days a week there are audio and other types of multimedia messages of much more rich content. If you like the short form on social media, check that out. Also a book that I wrote, How to Human Up in Modern Society, Heal Yourself and Save the World. It has some of these intersections between psychology, anthropology, and spirituality to point out to all these universal truths that exist, you know, through all these, you know, traditions of human thought, and regardless of what specific theological tradition you might come from, that they all have in common, where you might be able to find specifically in this situation, kind of deconverting from an extremist group, some solace in, you know, what healthy spirituality and faith looks like too. That would probably be very refreshing. Generally speaking, I think this is an experience that a ton of people are having right now in the world, in human civilization, in almost unprecedented numbers. We're becoming a more globally connected society, very literally. We just had a pathogen that connected us in a way that has never happened in the history of mankind. And information technology is doing it in very real ways as well. As information is easier to access, the very rigid, inflexible, controlling constructs of extremism are melted away more and more. So a lot of people are seeing the cracks as, you know, some of the tarnish of the veneer, you know, goes away. So if you're seeing this and feeling weird and it's not making sense, if you're receiving the call in a more spiritual or faith-based sense, that the call that you've been sold is might be a false bill of sale, you're probably right. And keep asking questions, keep seeking information that's outside of your community. We need you to free your mind from these oppressive constructs so you can be the awesome human that you're here to be, and you can do what you can do, where you can do, when you can do, for this globally connected community that is waking up, you know, as we speak. It's going to take all of us influencing the collective together and reclaiming our connection with our soul and with the cosmos, with whatever meaningful construct works for you.
Amen. I agree with you. I think the pandemic, while it was awful and hurt a lot of people and killed a lot of people, I also think it was almost like the seed of a global awakening where people were sitting around going, wait, do I want to be doing this job I'm unhappy in? Do I want to follow this religious leader? I do feel uncomfortable with this. Now I have the time to sit down and reflect on it. And everyone is just kind of changing their professions, leaving their religions at high numbers. And so I'm really happy that we have people like you who are helping people leave that high demand group, helping them find their self, their individuality, realizing that they're not alone, and you're giving them real time tips and tricks and things that they can do in their everyday life to become the person that they're meant to be, to help heal humanity. Like you just said, it's so important. I'm just talking in circles. Basically, I'm just saying yes to all of that.
Thanks, Shalice. That'll well.
I want to get all of your social media handles, lay them out so that everyone can go follow you.
Sure. Instagram and TikTok at HealingHumanity777. On YouTube, I think it might still be called Balance Man Plan. I'm not sure. It was at first, that's what I was calling the project, because it was the initial focus was specifically helping men deconvert from toxic elements of traditional masculinity and teaching them to be servant leaders.
That sounds like a part two, actually. A part two discussion of diving into the masculinity, the healthy masculinity. I think that would be a great video. Stay tuned, everyone.
There you go. Check that out. I have a few websites you can check out as well. LoganCohen.com is my most recent one that is, you know, focused on more what I have going on at any given time and what I'm offering moment to moment. There's another website that I created called BalancedManPlan.com, and it houses an online curriculum of coaching plans for men specifically who refuse to ask for help in person, to start getting some of that help and developing some of these skills to not only get the help in person, but begin helping them have that social and cultural deconversion process to a more integrated type of humanity. You can check out there's stuff going on out there, and I hope you find something that resonates with you somewhere.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your expertise with everybody. And this is a really powerful episode. So just thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. So for everyone listening, if you want to support the podcast, I just started a Patreon. So I want to thank Lacey Moss and Josh for being my new patrons. I really appreciate your support. And for everyone else listening and watching, follow your highest excitement, be conscious, and be well. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, it would mean a lot if you could like and subscribe on YouTube and leave a review or a comment to help with our visibility. You can also find me on social media at cults2consciousness or reach out by email at cults2consciousness@gmail.com.